Onochi Hashem Elokecha asher hotzeiticha meretz Mitzrayim. I am God, your God, who took you out of the land of Egypt. And I gave you then the sheet with the Eben Ezra on the Aseret HaDibrot, where the Eben Ezra says, Sha'olani Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi. Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi asked me. One of the few places where Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is mentioned in the Mefarshim al Chumash, Eben Ezra says, Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi asked me. And of course, this was the opening statement of the Talmud Chacham to the king of the Khazars, while the Christian and the Muslim had said, we believe in the God who created heaven and earth. When the Chover, and when the king of the Khazars asks the Chover, who do you believe in? So his opening statement is, I believe in God who took the Jewish people out of Egypt. And the king is taken aback. We went through all of this. The king is taken aback. I would have thought that you would have told me that you, as the Christian and the Muslim had said, that you believe in the God who is the creator of the whole awesome cosmos. And here you tell me you believe in God who took the Jewish people out of Egypt. To which the Chover tells him, have a little patience. Hear me out. Wait, and you will understand what I have in mind. It was there that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi established, which really runs like a fine thread through the whole Sefer HaKuzri. He says that the fundamental underpinning of all of Jewish belief is the historic experience. And that the historic experience, which a few million people were witness to, is something that is a fact in history and remains so regardless of what happens throughout the rest of history. And on that, that's the bedrock of Jewish faith. All right. So we already dealt with it. The only thing is, you can't help, you know, you come to shul, there are Shabbos sheets in shul. Ma'at min ha'or is one of the Shabbos sheets, a quality one, put out by Hanan Parat. So that same week that we were talking about Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi and the Eben Ezra, we spoke about it on Wednesday, and then on Friday, by the way, I get my copy of Ma'at Min Ha'or in my Makor Rishon. I get the newspaper Makor Rishon, then when you start shaking out the Makor Rishon, all sorts of things come out of the newspaper. You know, what Svarim are for sale, what's happening at Superfarm and Hipponeto, and you also get this sheet, Ma'at Min Ha'or. And I see what Hanan Porat writes, and of all things, I finally only got to reading it really yesterday, and a great idea occurred to me, and I just want to share it with you. I want to share it with you. Because it sheds a new light on the Kuzri. It sheds a new light on the Kuzri. There's the feeling, sort of, that, well, the Rambam and Chasdai Kraskas, the others, the Rav Yosef Albo, they're the philosophers. They're the philosophers par excellence. Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is the poet. Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is the Yiddish hearts of Jewish belief. We don't necessarily see him on the level of a Moreh Nevuchim. And that's a big mistake. That's a big mistake. So here, Hanan Parat, in this sheet, this is the main article, Hanan Parat brings, what Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi says in the Kuzri, and he brings the Eben Ezra. Let me remind you the Eben Ezra. You see, what he's going to do is say that there's a profound difference between the Eben Ezra and Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi. In the first column, down toward the bottom, there are the dark letters. You'll recall it, Sha'olani Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, Menuchato Kavod, Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, of blessed memory, had asked me, Lomo Hizkir, why does God mention Anochi Hashem Elokecha Asher Hotzeiticha Me'eretz Mitzrayim?
V'lo amar she'asiti shamayim v'aretz v'ani asiticha.
Why does God say, I am God who took you out of the land of Egypt? Why doesn't he say, I'm the God who created everything, and I'm your creator, I created you? In the next dark section, we get the thrust of the Ibn Ezra's answer, and we learn this as well. V'zu hayta tshuvati elav, this was my answer to Yehuda Levi. And I'll say the answer, and then we'll read it quickly. He says that there are different levels of Jews. Not everybody is capable of entering the world of philosophy. Not everybody's a philosopher. I even wonder how many philosophers are philosophers. But that's not a discussion for now. All right? So therefore, the Ibn Ezra says, God says, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I'm God, your God. That's a philosophic statement. If you're a philosopher, you will be able to understand that we're talking about the omniscient, the omnipotent, the first cause, the prime mover, the one who initiated the Big Bang, whatever you want to call him. But then God goes on to say in his first communication to the Jewish people directly from heaven, after he says, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I'm God your God, he says, Asher hotzeiticha me'eretz Mitzrayim, mi'beit avadim, who took you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. That second half of the sentence, Ibn Ezra says, is being told to the common folk, those of us who can't relate to the first cause and the prime mover, but we certainly can relate to a historic fact that God took us out of the land of Egypt. So he says, since there are different levels of human understanding, so God relates to people in a different way. Bist a philosopher, so you should believe in the prime mover, the first cause. You're not a philosopher? All right. You're also a Jew, so you believe in me because of the historic experience. According to the Ibn Ezra, that would mean that the historic experience of the Jewish people is really below the level of the profound philosophical approach to God. That's how the Ibn Ezra puts it quite clearly. There are different levels. Da, v'zu haitak tshuvati elav. This was my answer. Da, ki ein ma'alot b'nei adam shavod be'emunatam. You should know that the levels of people are not similar in their belief. V'yesh ravim, and he says over there, there are those, he leaves out the section where it says, there are those who understand philosophical concepts. And then there are others who can say, you know, my tata told me there's a God. I believe in the Eibishter, the Bashefa, the Heilige HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I believe in him. And would they be questioned by some intellectual apikotas? V'yesh rabim, there are many, shim yavo apikotas la'arer. If a heretic is going to come and question them, v'yoman, he's going to say, there is no God. Yosimu yadom lepiem. They put their hand on their mouths. Ki lo yedu lahashiv. They don't know how to answer. They don't know how to answer. They cannot respond on a philosophical level. Al Kain. Here is where the Ibn Ezra comes to this point. Therefore, also Hashem Yisbarach ototum of timat shehutzim Mitzrayim. That's why God made signs and miracles until he took them out of Egypt. Shakol rose. Everybody saw this. Even simple people, chachamim v'she'enam chachamim, those who are wise and those who are not wise, v'alkein hizgil lemaskil. So therefore, this is really the sum total of the Ibn Ezra. Lemaskil, to the intelligent person, God addresses, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, understand the meaning of the Godhead, the divinity, I don't know, whatever other kind of sophisticated terminology you want to use. The Hosef, and God adds, for the common folk, Asher Hotzi Ticha, I took you out of Egypt, Kadesh Yovin Hamaskil, Shein Hamaskil, the intellectual and the non-intellectual, both of them should know God. All right. Which, of course, if we were to assume that this is the same position that's taken by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. And remember, we are talking about what is a fundamental thread that runs through the entire Sefer. Then you know what would really emerge? It would emerge that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is talking to the common folk in Amcha. You know, it's some kind of a poor or a non-intellectual man's easy guide to an understanding of Judaism. So there was a fellow, Professor Heinemann, who wrote a major essay on Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, and he uses this particular exchange between the Evan Ezra and Rabbi Yehuda Halevi in order to take us to the depth of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's great contribution. And it's so good and it's so important, it puts the whole Sefer on a completely different level. In this second column, right over here, Hadat. Hadat lefi tfisato shel Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. Religion, according to the way Rabbi Yehuda Halevi understands it, makira et Elokim mitoch hofa'ato v'hidgaluto. It's worthwhile reading the Hebrew and translating it. According to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's understanding, the Jewish religion knows God mitoch hofa'ato, from his appearance, v'hidgaluto, and his revelation. And what he means is the way God appears to us in history. And watch what he's going to say now. Shekein ha-musag ha-malei shel ha-davar ha-eloki. A complete and full idea of the divine thing, divinity. Read philosophical approach to the knowledge of God. To fully grasp that, impossible. Mitchamek hitchamkud gibura. Meitfisat ha-seichel. It slips away. Mitchamek, l'hitchamek means it just slips away. It's slithery. The intellect is not truly able to fully comprehend an intellectual understanding of God. There's something about the intellectual that's very flimsy and it sweeps away. Ah. V'rak mitoch hidgalut. It's only through God's revelation. U'mitoch ha-historia efshar lahagia elav. It's only through Jewish history that you can arrive at it. Do you understand what this fellow is saying? According to Reb Evan Ezra, God says, Onochi Hashem Lekecho, intellectuals first. Poor people who are just not intellectual. Us, Amcha. So since we can't achieve that, so at least we can know a little history. God took us out of Egypt. So he says, no, the intellectual cannot be an intellectual without the historic experience. The historic experience comes first. And it's only by virtue of the historic experience that one is able to begin to grasp the idea of the divine. And on the basis of the historic experience, he can begin to build his intellectual edifice. But without the historic experience, the intellectual is nothing. Do you know how Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, if he would respond to Rabbi Evan Ezra, he would have said, Hashem asher hotzeiticha me'eretz Mitzrayim, who Hashem Elokecha. He would have put the historic experience first. But wait a minute, we're not finished. So he says, V'rak mitoch hidgalut, it's only through revelation, u'mitoch ha-historian, from history, efshar lahagi I love, you're able to get to it. Dafke b'chayei ha-emunah, dafke through the life of faith, boli de gilui mashehu. Something is revealed. There are ideas that can never be grasped by the critique of the pure mind alone. It has to be rooted first in the historic experience. V'rak b'di'eved, la'achas she'oto davar gunav el sedeh. What a beautiful sentence. It's only sort of as an afterthought. After oto davar gunav el sedeh ha'yediyah mitoch ha'ofot ha'historiot, when sort of the secret of God seeps into the mind via the historic experience, then it can begin to build on it. Yuchalim tzoed bituyo, it can find its expression b'lishon hamusagim hamufshatim, in abstract terminology. The abstract doesn't stand a chance alone. The abstract can only feed and live and grow and develop on the basis of the concrete historic experience. And Professor Heinemann goes on to say, Dafke machshava mekorid zo. This original thought, mashvel mifalo shel Halevi et gedulato, gives the work of Halevi, Rav Yehuda Halevi, its greatness. Ha'oleh ala machshava hamemutzat shel yimei habinayim, that takes him and lifts him above the general field of thought during the Middle Ages. It's gewaldig. But then I'm sitting there and I read it, and all of a sudden I came up most probably with my 10th pshat in a pasuk that every 10th, maybe 20th pshat. That's exactly what the Jewish people said at the Yam Suf. Ze keli van vehu elokei aviv aron emenu. What ze keli van vehu? I see. I experience. Ras ashif halayam, a maidservant at the sea, saw. She saw at the sea shore more than all the great prophets were able to see. And it's only after the great historic experience that the Jew can add Elokei Ovi Varom Emenu. The God of my fathers, the God of Avram, was the God of intellect, the God of a mind. Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov didn't see the great historical experiences. Theirs was the ability to arrive at an abstract understanding of God. So do you understand? This is Rav Yehuda Halevi. We can sum up all of Rav Yehuda Halevi in to Zek Keli Van Veyu. After I have the historic experience that now tells me clearly there is a God, now if I want to comprehend him intellectually, philosophically, begin to understand a bit of the essence of his being, I'm able to take the next step of Elokei Avi, the God of my father, which is clearly the God, a God of intellect, and then I see how great he rises above me. But everything has to begin with the historic experience. What an unbelievable understanding of Rav Yehuda Halevi. And I just missed it all of these years. At least that, what? Gunish Vashpetik. Better now than ever. Better now than ever. You know, I'm occasionally a shtickle anti-intellectual. And therefore I see in this that, listen, Geisa intellectual can't begin without being part of Amcha. Because the historic experience is something that we all share equally. Godol, Koton, Maskil, Eino Maskil, the great intellect and not the great intellect. In the words of the Evan Ezra, it seems like we, Amcha, we can't arrive at an intellectual understanding, so at least we can have a historical. No, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says precisely the opposite. I most probably now, as we go through different sections of the Kuzri, I'm going to be looking for further indications of this great contribution that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi made to Jewish philosophy. It will, of course, explain all those psukim that keep telling you, and all the mitzvahs that we fulfilled that are zechel liyitziat Mitzrayim. remembering history is so much a basic part of halacha, of all of Torah. B'chol dor v'dor chayev adam lirot et atzmo ki'ilu hu yotzo mi'mitzchayim. In every generation, a person has to see himself as though he went out of Egypt. By the way, it's great. I'm beginning to get a handle on a Shabbos HaGadol drasha. You understand? If I can expand this, I'll be in good shape. It means I've never had a Shabbos HaGadol drasha before Purim. For that matter, I never had it till about Thursday before Shabbos HaGadol. But it means that the whole Mitzrayim experience is not some kind of an amcha experience. It's the foundation upon which everything is built afterwards. He makes one further statement about Rav Yehuda HaLevi, and here I think he gives it a Hasidic tinge. In the next section, in the dark letters, he brings the famous statement of the Gaon Mivilna. I think we may have quoted it in the first year on Kuzri. The Gaon Mivilna said, "Ikarei emunat Yisrael v'Torah tluyim bo." Go down. Just one sentence there in dark, bold letters. This is what the Vilna Gaon said about the Sefer HaKuzri. Ikarei emunat tluyim bo. The fundamental principles of all faith depend on the Sefer HaKuzri. To me, I don't understand. One of the things that I don't understand, unless I'm making a mistake, the Sefer HaKuzri is the handbook of the Dati Leumi community in Eretz Yisrael. In the Hezda Yeshivas, in all the yeshivot of the Dati Leumi community, the text par excellence is the Kuzari. In the yeshiva world, I remember when I was in yeshiva, I was one of the first that opened up a Kuzari. There were one or two people that I remember in the Agudas Yisrael world of New York, which I grew up. You understand? I moved radically. I'm not sure what direction I went. I can't figure it out. In other words, as a child, I was a member of Pirchei Agudas Yisrael in Williamsburg at 616 Bedford Avenue. Mike Tress, Olav Shalom, was my group leader, and me, understand, I'm sitting there last night with all of these Dati Leumi rabbis next to Rav Avram Shapira and Rav Mordechai Eliyahu and all of the rest of the right wing extremists. You understand? I think I moved a little bit in the last 40, 50 years. So in this world, in the Dati Leumi community, the Sefer HaSfarim is the Kuzari. And in nearly every edition that comes out, they have this one sentence of the Vilna Gaon on an introductory page. Ikarei emunat Yisrael v'Torah tluyim bo. The very fundamentals of the faith of Israel and Torah all depend on this Sefer. Now, if something, a statement of this sort that's made by the Vilna Gaon should already be enough reason to make it a handbook of Torah study, and it isn't. In the yeshiva world, I certainly don't believe. It certainly wasn't when I went to yeshiva. If I wouldn't have had older brothers who are already a little bit different, I might not have known about it at all. And by the way, you know, I first opened up the Kuzri when I remember learning with my Chavrusa. We were learning the Sechta Rosh Hashanah, and we came to the Rishonim that deal with the question of the dateline. And in some of the research that I did, I find out that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi spoke about the international dateline. That brought me to the Sefer HaKuzri. Because the international dateline became an important issue by Klal Yisrael when the Miri Yeshiva came to Shanghai, to Kobe, Japan, and then Shanghai. It became important to know, where does the day change? Some place on the face of this earth, and when you bring the globe, I'll be able to show you that the day has to change some place on the face of this earth. Then it became a real Shiloh, but all right, we'll talk about that. That's just if I have the presence of mind to be able to prepare it well before. In other words, know it well enough to teach it to you. But we'll do it. We'll do it. We'll try it. He brings one more sentence from Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi. You remember we learned about the Chove, the Talmud Chacham, says to the king, if somebody would tell you about the king of India, that he's a great king, he's a mighty king, he's powerful, would you have to believe it? So he says, why should I believe it? What proof is there that there's even a king in India altogether? And certainly that the king, if there is a king of India, who says that this king of India has anything to do with me? So let India have a king. Who cares? So then the Talmud Chacham says to him, what happens if an emissary is going to come from the king of India and he's going to give you something that was written by the king of India himself? And you can see that this could not have been written by anybody but the king of India. And he also gives you all sorts of instructions that are good for your health and good for your mental well-being. What would you do then? So, and he says, then the king of the Khazar says, I have a text that comes from him, and it seems clear that this is from the king of India, and there's an emissary. The emissary clearly is saying the truth. Then of course I would believe in the king of India. So then he goes on to say, what happens if you have an unusual human being, the kind that never ever walked the face of this earth, a Moshe, who comes to you with Aseret HaDibrot Luchot that were written by God, would you now have some kind of a closer relationship to him? So he says, yeah. And then that next sentence, Az Hayiti Ma'amin, then I would believe, Ki Shilton Melech Hodu, that the rule of the king of Hodu, Upikudato, and his instruction, his laws, Nogim Gamli. They affect me too. They affect me too. In this one sentence, there's a great deal more. And if you just want to get the idea, and with this, enough of this. Let's take a look at this little section over here. You have no idea how thrilled I was when I found this floating out of my Makor Rishon. One of the great Hasidic luminaries was the Yid HaKudish from Pshischa. And he said the following, would it have said, I am God, your God, who created heaven and earth? Man would say to himself, Omnam adir hu Elokim. Yes, true, God is mighty, he's awesome, he created the whole world. Avul hu lo yitaseg bi ubim yanai haputim. But this great God who created a whole cosmos, what a world, he's not really involved with me and my little needs. Al-Kain, Korei Lav Hashem Yidbarach Va'omelo, that's why God calls out to Moshe and to the Jewish people and says, Ani Hashem Asher Hotzeiticha Min Habotz. I'm the God that took you out of the blotter. I took you out of the mud. In classic Hasidic way. You know what HaKadosh Baruch Hu's opening statement is to the Jewish people? I care about you. The God of heaven who created heaven and earth might not be the one who cares about me, But Anihu Asher Hotzei Ticham in Abatz, I took you out of the blotter, out of the mud. Bo Eilai B'choleid, come to me at all times. V'havela Fanai, and bring before me et Dagotecho, your worries, Umitsuko Techa, and that which oppresses you. Tell me your tzachas. In other words, and this is clear in a number of the statements of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, the Anochi Hashem Elokecha Asher Hotzeiticha Me'eretz Mitzrayim is not only the foundation, the revelation that is the foundation of the entire edifice of intellect, it also sends the most important message to Klal Yisrael. How awesome and how great you're going to discover that I am. I care about you. I care about you. I took you out of the blotter once. I'll take you out of the blotter again. In other words, in this one sentence, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was setting the stage for an eternal relationship, a relationship between God and the Jewish people. All of tefillah, all of prayer, everything depends on this, that there's somebody there that's listening, that there's somebody there that cares. Without that, forget it all. What an amazing... So now you know why I got all excited. Now you know how to go. In addition to the fact, of course, that I have to give you a handout, or you, I say you always feel cheated if I don't give you something, so I gave you something. Okay. Why? He's writing on every parsha. He writes on every parsha. Every week, this comes out every week. And some of them are just absolutely. This is, I think, the second greatest. I once gave a shiur 2 years ago on one of his great columns, and you know, good. I think it's better that he's out of politics. What? Yes, he wrote. Yes, if you go further, he brings right below it is Naomi Shema's famous song Al Advash Val Ha'oketz. All right. So what's in the last paragraph? Al Kolele Shmor Nali Keli Hatov Al Advash Val Ha'oketz Al Hamar V'Hamatok Al Notar Kor Natua Al Tishkachet HaTikva Hashiveni. Bring me back for Shuva El Haoretz HaTovah, to the good land. There's somebody there that's listening. So, I'll talk. Yes. Oh, you're getting political already. Absolutely. Good. And you're absolutely unashamed about it all. And I'm so thrilled with that. I'm sure they're going to start singing it now. If Sharon ever dreams of removing Jews from their homes, but all right. We're in. We are in number 97. I'll tell you exactly what page. I think it's page 67 or 69. Yeah, we are. It starts on 67. I want to complete the. Okay, I must complete it now. I have 20 minutes left. I'll just reiterate what we said last week. The Chaver had been speaking about the greatness of the Jewish people. The greatness of the Jewish people, by the way, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is not at all embarrassed about establishing what is really, in a sense, a racist theory. But, you know, the word racist doesn't have to be a bad word. The word racist is a bad word when people are going to, as a result of it, discriminate and do racist cleansing. You should know, real prejudice in this world, there were all sorts of hatreds. From the days of Cain and Hevel, there was hatred in the world. But prejudice against people because of race, color, I'm not saying creed, because people were killing themselves, or not themselves, killing others because of creed from the very, very beginning. there were idolatrous people that waged war with one another. Most wars that were waged in history were about religion. Economics and land may have been the excuses, but most wars were waged because of religion. All right, so, you know, we're living in a world that has an ugly side to it. We sort of, so to speak, can understand Christians and Muslims killing each other. You can understand that. That's good reason. We can certainly understand Christians killing Jews and Muslims killing Jews. That's understood. But the idea of the idea of killing or discriminating against people of different color or different race, or for that matter, even the idea of a German Aryan race, this kind of talk was hardly heard, made no impact on the world until the second half of the 19th century. And it coincided with Darwin. Mamish coincided with Darwin. The negative aspect of the theory of evolution was, obviously, that there are some people who evolved fully, and then there are people, Bushit, who just didn't evolve fully. Maybe in another 10 billion years, blacks will finally turn white. But we did it first. So therefore, we are superior to others. All of this, the whole idea of prejudice because of race or color, was hardly known in the world until after the theory of evolution. Now, I said that for some reason. I said that for some reason.
You said you started with the greatness of Jewish theory, and you're not apologizing.
Oh, that's it. Perfect. What would I do without you? Kegen wuss aber dis gesucht, that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, his theory would be called racist. In other words, that Adam, the genes of Adam, went over to Hevel, and when Hevel was killed, there was nobody left that carried those genes until God gave him Shait, and Adam, Shais, Enosh, Keno, Me'al, Yored, the genes of Adam went until finally it arrived at Avram. From Avram it went to Yitzchak, from Yitzchak it went to Yaakov, from Yaakov it went to the 12 tribes, and therefore you had 12 people from whom God was able to create a great and eternal nation. So it's really racist. There was nothing behind this racism that therefore looked down upon any other people or said, go kill the rest of the world. Yes? Yeah, true. We're going to talk about that. We're going to get to that too. All right, we're going to get to that. Good. No, we'll get it. He's going to talk about it. Okay. Anyway, so here, the Talmud Chacham had told the king what an unusual and an exceptional people we are, and what great historic experiences, Kriyas Yamsuf, revelation at Sinai. And then, of course, the king says, wait a minute, don't be carried away with all of this greatness that you're saying about your people. Only 40 days after they received Torah at Sinai, they were dancing around a golden calf in the desert. Yes, and we mentioned last week the ugly article in the Jerusalem Post about some disco that was having a dance in the desert, and they, on a stage in the middle, they put on a cow, so that not only are Jews from Tel Aviv dancing in the desert, they're dancing around an egel. And Jerusalem Post said that it was so anathema to these secular Jews there, they left the dance hall and they went straight back to Tel Aviv. Even they couldn't take that kind of chiloniness. All right. Anyway, so here he has, this is the question. The question is, great people, chosen people, and they dance around the ego. So Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's position is, and we're in the middle of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, his position is that there was absolutely no idolatry involved in the sin of the ego. According to Rashi, it was idolatry. According to the Ramban, it was not idolatry, but they wanted a leader. They felt leaderless, rudderless. Moshe, who had taken them out of Mitzrayim and took them through the desert, has been gone now for 40 days, and they don't know where he is. They don't know when he's coming back. That's the Ramban. According to Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, what they wanted was something that is really, to our way of thinking, it's a very innocent thing. All they wanted was something that they could look to as an object that represents God. Not that the object is God. And he's going to say, we come into shuls and we look at the Aron Kodesh. And that assists us in our ability to concentrate on praying to God. By the way, he says, during the period of the first Bet HaMikdash, and even during a large period of the second temple, there were no shuls. You know what a shul would have been looked at? A shul would have been looked at as a rejection of the Bet HaMikdash in Yerushalayim. They didn't build buildings in which to pray. Buildings in which to pray would have seemed like a rejection of Yerushalayim. Didn't do that. I mean, the first real synagogues that we have, I don't know where did they go back to? 1200, 1300, all right, so up in the Golan, I think they have. You know where the oldest one is? You know where the oldest synagogue in this country is? I'm going to give you one guess. If you don't get it, I'm one guess. Aza. You're a tour guide? I'm going to better check with my wife and find out. She's taking the course too, see if she knows that the. All right. No, we're not going to ask her now. We're not going to embarrass. I just asked, where's the oldest synagogue in Israel? No, I'm not starting off with you. It was already said by somebody who's a tour guide that said it was Aza. There's an ancient synagogue in Aza. You understand the Aza that's not part of Eretz Israel. It's not Jewish. You understand? Yeah, okay. Aza. Now, which Zmiris do we sing that was composed in Aza? I'll give you another hint. It's a main street in Givat Shaul. All right, that's two hints and you still don't get it. All right, and I'll give you one other. It's between Rehov Kanfei Nesharim and Rehov Givat Shaul. Najara. Rabbi Yisrael Najara is the one who wrote Kori Bon Olam. Is there a home that doesn't sing Kori Bon? All right. And it was composed in Gaza. He composed not only that, but another 400 zmiros and poems in Gaza. Okay. I think somebody finally should make a collection. There was once somebody who attempted to make a collection of all of the writings of Rabbi Yisrael Najara. He was a very interesting fellow. Brilliant, genius. He also liked a little of the bitter stuff. There was a chassidish, poetic kind of neshama that Rabbi Yisrael Najara, aguta l'chayim in the morning. But he was an unbelievable, his writings are magnificent, magnificent. All Aza. All right, page 68. Someplace in the middle of 68, it says, many views and opinions were expressed. You know what he's talking about? That here is a people in confusion. Moshe is up on the mountain. They haven't seen him. And they're all in turmoil. What should they do? Now, what happens when there's a problem? I mean, true to form, there are many opinions expressed by Jews, you understand? Everybody has an opinion, and you have to listen to everybody's opinion. Many views and opinions were expressed till at last some decided to do like the other nations and seek an object an object in which they could have faith, without, however, prejudicing the supremacy of him who had brought them out of Egypt. They're not challenging God. They just want an object that represents him. I mean, a good Saba or Safta walks around with a picture of an eagle. So, of course, you're blessed that you can't, the purse won't hold that many, you know, so okay. But it's an object. It's an object that's a reminder. It's an object toward which one can look. And he says further, on the contrary, this was to be something to which they could point when relating the wonders of God, as the Philistines did with the ark when they said that God dwelt within it. You know, as we started pointing out toward the end of this year last week, this was not an act of rebellion. On the contrary, it was an act of fornicate. The ones who wanted the Egel because they had this profound need to be able to express their inner feelings while they have something at which they can look. That makes a great deal of difference. Just one second. Okay. I hope it's all right. Okay. On the contrary, this was to be something to which they could point when relating the wonders of God, as the Philistines did with the ark when they said that God dwelt within it. We do the same with the sky. This is the last thing we read. When we look heavenward and we say, Gott in Himmel. What do you mean, Gott in Himmel? God is not here. It's an object that represents to us God. That's all they wanted. Which means that this is light years away from idolatry. It was not an act of rejection of God. He's going to go on to say what it was, in fact, was something that was prohibited by a negative commandment in Torah. You can't make that. And they did it out of a sense of extreme piety. We do the same with the sky and every other object concerning which we know that it is set in motion by the divine will exclusively and not by any accident or desire of man or nature. Their sin consisted in the manufacture of an image of a forbidden thing and in attributing divine power to a creation of their own, something chosen by themselves without the guidance of God. Some excuse may be found for them in the dissension which had broken out amongst them. Now, first of all, he now begins to mitigate the degree of the sin. So first of all, you have to know that there was a great deal of dissension. There was a great deal of dissension. The very fact that there's dissension already means we're not talking about something that all of Israel decided upon doing. And in the fact that out of 600,000 souls, the number of those who worshipped the calf was below 3,000. So that's already a highly mitigating factor. By the way, what percentage is 3,000 out of 600,000? That's a 0.5%? Now, if you're really going to talk about the totality of Klal Yisrael, which was approximately 3 million, we're talking about really a very, very small number of people who were involved in this sin. For those of higher station who assisted in making it, but you know what Rav Yehuda HaLevi has to explain? What was our own HaKohen's hand in all of this? So here he's going to explain what Aaron had in mind. For those of higher station who assisted in making it, an excuse might be found in the fact that they wished to clearly separate the disobedient from the pious in order to slay those who would worship the calf. There are some times that you have to let what's seething beneath the surface, let it come out. Let it come out to the light of day, so then we're going to know who are the weak elements in the Jewish people, and that ultimately we have to rid ourselves of them. This, he says, was Aaron HaKohen's plan. He wants to see what's going to happen, and then we will religiously cleanse the Jewish people of any who had within themselves the potential of pseudo-idolatry. On the other hand, they sinned in causing what was only a sin of intention to become a sin indeed. In other words, but we cannot completely exonerate Aaron HaKohen, because while what may have been a sin of intention, he caused that it became a sin indeed. But this sin was not on a par with an entire lapse from all obedience to him who had led them out of Egypt, as only one of his commands was violated by them. One of the 613. And that one is not really the sin of idolatry at all. God had forbidden images, and in spite of this, they made one. Now, not every image is idolatry. An image is idolatry only when you worship it. If you don't worship it, it's not idolatry. They should have waited and not have assumed power, have arranged a place of worship, an altar and sacrifices. There were other ways in which they could express their sense of devotion to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Yes. So I'll tell you, you know what you're going to have to say, as we have had to say a number of times in the past, and we're going to have to say it a number of times in the future. There are certain ideas that we have because we were taught medrashim that said so. And you have to know, when you're dealing with medrash, there are medrashim that say one thing and there are those that say the opposite. And one of the classic examples where I had pointed it out here, and subsequently since then, I found an amazing Meshech Chochma that bears out what we said over here. And maybe if I remember, I'll learn that Meshech Chochma with you. The question of, you're going to ask anybody, why did God take Jews out of Egypt then? They're going to tell you. Because they had sunk to the 49th level of Tumah. And if he wouldn't take them out of the butts, the Heilige Yid HaKudish Mepshischa, if he wouldn't have schlepped them out of the butts, they would have sunk and been submerged forever. That's one medrash. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's description of the Jewish experience in Egypt is a completely different one. You will recall, he describes there as people who did not in any way become submerged within the greater civilization that was Egypt. They maintained fiercely their identity. Nobody married out of the faith. They continued to maintain their identity in all sorts of ways. The other medrashim that we know about not changing their clothes, not betraying one another, they continued to speak Hebrew, albeit the children maybe with an Egyptian accent. But all right, that happened. So the Meshech Chochma says, there are pashut, it's a machloket hamedrashim, which ultimately becomes a machloket between panoyim. And Rabbi Yehuda Halevi goes on to describe that these are people who believed with perfect faith, an imam in the Muna Shlema, that the Rabbeinu Shem is going to send a Mashiach to take us out of here. He described how they lived with this anticipation from day to day. So you know what? He's obviously taking a position in terms of how he sees the Mitzrayim experience. He's obviously taking a position here that it was not a it was not idolatry that became for them something that was that they went into some kind of an orgy of sorts. No, the only time orgy appears in Tanakh or in Gemara is with regard to real avodah zarah. The Gemara says, "Lo avdu Yisrael avodah zarah elo kedei lahatir lahen arayot b'tahesia." Jews worshipped idols only in order to permit them illicit relationships in public. One cannot engage in illicit relationships as long as you believe in a Rabbein Shalom. You got to get him out of the consciousness, otherwise you're not going to enjoy nothing. It's going to be one big waste of time. You know, what the Gemara is saying is very clear. Somebody who's going to say he has emuna problems, or somebody who's going to drop Yiddishkeit and attempt to leave you with the impression that this was a profound intellectual decision that he arrived at, be very cautious of believing that. He may be starting in the middle of the story. He may have wanted to leave Yiddishkeit, and then ultimately he can't say, listen, I wanted to leave Yiddishkeit because I just wasn't interested in keeping Shabbos, or I wanted to do Kol Dovar Osa. You can't say that. That doesn't sound too good. So therefore, you create the alibi. The alibi is, I couldn't understand these psukim in Torah, this statement of the rabbis, it was absolutely shaking, etc., etc. So, you know, it always depends on what comes first. Anyway, we'll continue. Yitzchak, next week I'll give you a brief précis of the what he finishes, and then I believe we're going to go into the second essay. Second essay. All right. You see, Rhoda? I even remember 2 minutes too late, but all right. Anyway, everybody, all be gesund. You should all be well. That's a very good question you've asked. It's a very good question you've asked. I can tell it in one word, one sentence, but then it can be a course for 10 years. For 10 years. The purpose of Medrash is to express ideas, not necessarily to establish historic facts. The ultimate point of a medrash is to express an idea. It can be a parable. It can be a takeoff. It does not necessarily have to reflect historic reality. But that needs Perush Gadol. It needs a great deal of elaboration. And by the way, there can also be genuine differences of opinion between medrashim. The Ruach HaKodesh deals only with the ideas. All right.